So, Jeff, how does a guy that flies as part of his routine behavior misjudge his capabilities to the point where he's now chasing his airplane to the final approach fix?
Well, if you think about it, this pilot sort of lives in two worlds, right? I mean, he is out there flying in the nasty weather, on a mission, well-trained, in his helicopter, right? So self-perception-wise, he's an excellent high-end pilot, knows everything backwards and forwards. It seems like that's also applied to his physical flying of the Mooney. That came quickly, even though it's fixed wing. He doesn't have as much experience there, but that came quickly. The place that he's been lacking is in understanding his avionics. So that's kind of where this whole thing turns to me. He anticipated the turn inbound. He, you know, had the airplane already starting to descend, went and looked for the thing that should be there and would have been there with an ILS, and it wasn't there. And that's why I think with a one-button push, I'm willing to go for it. If he pushes the button and it sequences forward, the glide path is there, I think he's proficient enough to catch it or in the chase early on go, nope, I really did blow it and go missed approach. But I wouldn't pull the plug on it just yet.
Jeff, can we discuss the choices a bit here? You say the missed approach might be the safest choice.
Right.
But you're selecting option one.
That's right.
Can you talk about that a little bit, why you're doing that?
Because we don't always select the safest choice. This is a certain amount of inherent risk in what we're doing. I mean, he's flying a single-engine airplane IFR. There's inherent risk in that. And on the risk-benefit equation, you say, well, this is an acceptable level of risk for this perceived benefit. And I think at this point, at that decision moment, there's one more opportunity to get back and established on a glide path in the descent without crossing over that line into unacceptable risk.
But let me just ask one further question on that. If you dive a bit to capture the glide path, aren't we going against the stabilized approach philosophy to some degree?
Sure. Initially, to dive a bit to catch it, to restabilize. I don't think it's a digital kind of thing. You would say that would mean carrying that logic a little bit further. Anytime you deviated and the glide path was below you, on the approach going down, you were stabilized, you got distracted for a minute, oops, the glide path's below me, but I still think I can get there without undue destabilization of the approach, get back on, I'm reestablished, I'm good. You've never done that and gone down and grabbed a glide path that was just a little bit below you.
I plead the Fifth Amendment.
Fair enough.
I would like to say that in this situation, there might be a tailwind as well, which would make that different. But I'm going to argue with you, Jeff, about one button push. There is another one button push had this pilot really been prepared. And I teach my clients, and I'm sure maybe the rest of you do, flying with this equipment, if there is an ILS to the same airport where there's an RNAV, number one, I'll look at minimums. In this case, the minimums for the ILS are 25 feet lower than the minimums for the RNAV. Had it been a ceiling issue, I would have chosen the ILS. But the other thing is, for me, it's belt and suspenders. And though I have loaded the RNAV 10 into the Garmin, I've put the localizer in the active frequency of the nav. And the one button push is the CDI button. And I'm right there because the glide slope is exactly the same. The only thing that's different is that the minimums are a little lower on the ILS. So there are two options for one button push to save this.
And I would agree with that if it had been belt and suspenders. This is belt and, oh, look, I could run over there and grab the suspenders and put them on when my belt fails. Because he hasn't ID'd that glide slope. He hasn't briefed that approach or any of those things.
I agree he hasn't, but proper training would have said before he even called for this approach, before he even called Norfolk and said, I've got the one-minute weather requesting, it would have been done and set up and ID'd.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, I'm not going to say that I've never done what you propose here.
You're pleading the fifth.
No, I'm willing to admit that I have probably done that at a time when I was a much more current and proficient instrument pilot than I am today. Today, I can tell you that I can only The only thing I have time to do once I pass that final approach fix is fly the airplane. I simply can't be distracted by resetting things or tuning radios or rebriefing an approach. So my personal habit is if everything isn't perfect at the final approach fix, I'm not going to go. This also sort of goes to the term salvaging the approach. And I think we've all heard how that, you know, can come out. So for me, it's a missed approach. And it may mean not getting into this airport because if that thunderstorm is coming close.
Jeff, I have to take exception with, you know, the decision. I think it's consistent with your pilot because his own failure to self-analyze got him in this situation, you know, in the same, you know, ego, I think may force him or may lead him to the path you follow where the safer option would be, you know, to catch back up with the airplane, realizing, hey, I blew it. I need to, you know, catch back up with the airplane. You can chase the airplane or you can catch back up with it. Chasing the airplane, I think, is filled with negative possibilities. John?
And to follow up on that and to paraphrase your response earlier to Bob about your choices, to paraphrase, it would be you're going to give it a shot, but if it doesn't work, you're going to do a missed approach. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. So what's your decision point then? Is it passing through 1,500 feet or 1,000 AGL? Or when do you abandon this attempt and realize that, you know, you're screaming downhill now trying to catch the glide slope? And when do you make the decision to go around?
You know, that's an excellent question. Is to, you know, I've always been a big proponent of objective abort points rather than subjective ones, you know, for takeoffs, for, you know, approaches to short runways, bush landings, things like that, to set an objective abort go, no go point. And there isn't one here. I think all of us have a sense, a feeling of what that is on an ILS approach, because realize we're, or any vertical guidance approach, to my mind, we're still in the transition here, the transition from level flight outside the final approach fix to stabilized and on the glide path descent. Now, in a perfect world, that looks perfectly coordinated, right? You know, the gear go down at just the right place with just the right power back, and the glide path needle is coming into the center of the case, and it just stays there. Like, that's great. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes we bobble along with, oh, there was a little bit of a tailwind, a little less power than my normal configuration, or a little more. There is that transition zone that we allow, and maybe it would be a good SOP to say, look, I've got that first 700 feet, 1,000 feet of whatever to get it perfect. And if it's not perfect by then, if I'm still tweaking, then no. It's sort of like turning final for, you know, any approach. That first turn to final when you're in, you know, a visual approach from a pattern, I should say. You're making the turn, and as you roll out, you know, there's a little bit of wind correction, and, you know, ideally you were perfectly lined up with the runway, but maybe you were a little bit off, and you give yourself a certain amount down the final approach course to get stabilized, and most people say, look, if by 500 AGL I don't got it, it's a missed approach. That would be sort of the equivalent here, right? There's that zone where we all kind of allow a little bit of work, and how much varies based on, you know, who we are and how proficient we are and how long we've been doing this, or, you know, have forgotten how to do it well, right? So, but we for instrument approaches, I haven't really thought about it. But yeah, that would be interesting to formalize a point further down rather than a feel.
The airline in, you know, pretty much any large aircraft it's going to be 1,000 AGL, right? Is if you're not stabilized by then, you're going around.
Well, at the airline I worked for, it was 500. We had to have
on an instrument
parameter stabilized at 500. Yeah.
But that's a hard number.
So we've got 1,500 feet here to mess around with it by airline standards, right?
Yeah, you know, so
I can go for this.
No, you only got 1,000.
Okay. Well, he said. That's right, 500.
It's all about the standards too, though. I mean, we're talking about a person that, you know, that is a trained professional versus, you know, we all pilots come in all shapes and sizes, and this pilot, you know, let's deal with the human factors here. This guy is highly motivated to get on the ground, and he's highly motivated to get on the ground in a hurry. And might that have already impacted his decision, and might that impact future decisions, you know, as he's chasing the airplane? And once again, he is a professional pilot in his day job, But he's not in his day job now. He's in, you know, another venue, which is quite different than the one that he knows and is very, very comfortable with.
And how many of us have rushed to an airport to beat a thunderstorm?
To beat a thunderstorm and to see your fiancé.
Or your future fiancé. You're hoping.
But, you know, get-there-itis, get-home-itis has been the has brought a lot of pilots to its knees.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And that's, I think, one of the other takeaways from this scenario is that knowing your equipment, if you're going to do something a little out of the ordinary, like a tight turn to final, like he messed this up by requesting the RNAV approach. And there was a second link in the chain of the controller should have said, unable, I can't do that. I have to deny that request, however you'd want to word it. If had he chosen the ILS approach, a similar set of vectors, a similar turn, he could have proceeded direct using his GPS. He would have seen that glide path coming down as the localizer was coming in.
There would have been no mystery there.
No mystery at all, and it all would have worked out. So that's, ironically, we talk around this table a lot about how, you know, in the weather, these LPV approaches, it's great, stabilized, the signal is solid. But there are situations where actually that gets in your way because of the constraints around it.
There should have also been another heads up for him if he knew his equipment, which in the suspend mode for the RNAV, the glide path isn't there.
Right.
And so he has no idea where he is situationally with that glide path. Is he above it? Is he below it? Is he right at it? That's all missing until it unsuspends.
It's amazing how many pilots don't use those kind of cues with RNAV approaches. I mean, one of my things is like the enunciation of your minimums on the GPS as you're coming towards the final approach fix or wherever it happens to enunciate for your GPS. That's like your fail flag and your ID on an ILS. You get these pilots who are so used to like, oh, it's an ILS approach. And they're like, I pushed the nav button and I heard some Morse code, so that's good. And they turn it off. But they don't, just like the GPS is there. I punched in the approach and now I'm following the glide path. And like, when did that sequence and say LPV, did you notice? You know, I love a great training thing is when they're not looking to go into the AUX pages and turn off SBAS, you know, satellite-based augmentation system. And now when that GPS rolls over on sequence, it just says LNAV. And people are just coming, you know, like, where's my glide slope? I just, you know, where as they're descending, they're like, where's the glide path? Where's the glide path? And it's like, it told you about 2 miles ago that you weren't going to get one. But it's not part of people's procedures.
As we look at this scenario, you know, I'm seeing the classic chain of events taking us, you know, not necessarily to an accident because this is not, we're not there yet, but we have had a series of small mistakes, you know, that if unbroken can bring us to that accident site or once again. And in this case here, I don't think we're there yet, but we're on a path here where there's been several things have gone wrong. We have a chance to fix them or we can, in a panic, maybe, you know, make another mistake.
Well, certainly from this scenario, Jeff, I was not aware that the controller could not clear you direct to the final approach fix on a GPS approach. So I've taken your lesson to the wise here. It says if you want a tight turn at the final approach fix, request the ILS.
And I wanted to talk a little bit more about that too and how most controllers are not pilots. They have no idea what a GPS box looks like. And if you start talking about unsuspending and CDIs and VLOCs and stuff, it's Greek. It's Greek. You know, you're looking at a radar display which has a final approach course line on it, and there's a little hash mark at the final approach fix, which is the same for both approaches, both for the RNAV and the ILS. And the controller is looking at, okay, so airplane A has to go here, but the same guy over here can go there. You know, it's just not kind of in that mindset. And they don't really, most people don't have a real good understanding of that there's two different sets of rules. You know, there was a recent change where you can go direct to an IF now without the procedure turn and stuff, and which was brought about by all those confusion points from two different people talking two different languages. Yet the controller is really only looking at that one little line on the display and the hash mark. And he's been, like you said, he's been vectoring people to that point all day long. And now all of a sudden this guy wants to do something different. And hey, you requested, have at it, have fun.
Here's your rope.
Yeah.
Just because the ATC says you can doesn't mean you should.
Right. Actually, they, you know, it's almost like a negative can. It's, I can't really deny it, so I guess I'm implicitly approving it, as opposed to actually assigning this and you know, approving it. It's almost like a passive thing, a passive approval. Well, he requested it, so he must be able to do it, as opposed to initiating the action.
So it sounds like, Jeff, you know, just by way of looking at where we are and where we're going, the guy still has some options available. He can proceed safely. So maybe that's where we're going is to, nothing inherently dangerous has occurred yet. But does this guy in this situation recognize where he is to the point where he's going to do the right thing?
One other point that I wanted to bring up in this, and I think Doug, you talked about a little bit about it, is training. You think about the amount of training that's required to operate this airplane. None. Zero. Okay. You could have got your instrument rating 25 years ago in a 172 with a single NAVCOM, and now you jump in this Mooney with a glass panel. Absolutely no training is federally required. You know, there may be other training requirements and stuff. So, and there's a lot to this button pushing, knobology, and knowing all these nuances and stuff. So how does a conscientious pilot stay up with that? By enlisting professional help, that's one way. You know, reading manuals doesn't work for people.
It's a start.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some who haven't even gone there.
Yeah,
but a simulator downloaded from the manufacturer could help.
How about, you know, what kind of checkout did this guy get in the airplane? He said he progressed fairly quickly into it. And what kind of recurrent training is required in something like this too? So,
well, single pilot IFR, you know, it creates challenges. Yeah. And once again, people bring their personalities to the cockpit. This guy had a personality or a background that led him to believe he could handle this. But, you know, the challenges on that particular day, you know, were ones that he, you know, was chasing the airplane. At some point, you need to catch up with the airplane and put yourself ahead of the airplane before it takes you to a bad spot.